à l'intention des responsables politiques qui doivent l'entendre et faire une différence pour cette communauté. MonIRC.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, in Burnaby, the Simon Fraser University Residents Hall Association is calling on SFU to lower residence costs to below market value rates, as well as to improve transparency about how resident fees are set and increased. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF has more. In Prince George, community members from across northern BC gathered to reflect on the past, present, and future of the Highway of Tears at the 20th Anniversary Symposium. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio was there to report. And the Hamilton Marsh Regional Park and Conservation Area has now become Nanaimo Regional District's 13th regional park. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo dives in. And last week, the Smithers Legion came alive with music and community spirit as residents gathered to celebrate the Bulkley Valley's watersheds with an evening of concerts hosted by a local advocacy group, What Matters in Our Valley, which blended live performance with the urgent conversations about a proposed Telco coal project. Pam Hassan at CICK News reports. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. At the beginning of this year, the Simon Fraser University Residence Hall Association released a petition demanding that SFU residents and housing prioritize affordability for on-campus student housing. As stated in the petition, the Residence Hall Association is calling on SFU to keep residence costs meaningfully below market rates and to be transparent about how residence fees are set and how increases are justified. To learn more about the association's specific calls for action, as well as if there have been any updates on this situation since the petition was first released in January, CJSF was joined in studio by Venetia Kajan, president of the Residence Hall Association. Please take a listen to our conversation.
My name is Venetia. I'm the president of Residence Hall Association.
Okay. I wanted to speak with you today because I had come across a petition that the Residence Hall Association had put out, essentially demanding that SFU do more to make residents more affordable for students. Things like having housing in particular be below market price, which is something that currently SFU is not doing. I guess I would like to know more about the position in your words and why it came to be in the first place.
Yeah, I was reached by the mainly students living in new renovated McTaggart building, and they had complaints like, it doesn't make sense, it's still the same building, old structure, nothing new is visibly renovated except the internal thing, and they're asking students to pay more rent than expected. It's like 4K, so which
4,000 per semester?
Per semester, yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember exact price, but before the building closed, it was like 3,000 something, which was kind of reasonable at that time because it's a building which have its own kitchen. You cook by yourself. You don't have to have a meal plan, which was very convenient for students, which didn't require the meal plan, and it was in a affordable price range. And students were like, they renovated the building and still it's the same services they're getting before the building closed. There's nothing new services, and but the price of the dorm is increased. So which made RHA to consider to have a petition to reach other students who might have the same issue. Those who have been living in residence for long term, they can sense the increase in the prices compared to students who just coming for the first term. They, for them, it's like, okay, it's the price, because residents doesn't show the previous prices unless you go and dig in archive prices.
Could you detail, I guess, what some of the specific requests in the petition are?
Our main request is either conceal the prices, reduce the prices, or if not, show us why they need to increase the prices to have a transparency.
You know, this petition was put out about over a month ago at this point. Have you had any communications with SFU so far regarding it?
Yeah, residents did reach us to have a meeting with RHC team and to discuss what main concerns or what made RHC to have a petition on out. And we did put on table that we understand there is inflation going on and we understand there is increase in prices all around in the Canadian society, but we don't understand where the money is going in. We are paying for the services, but we are not seeing increase in the services. It's still the same old services since 4 years I have seen around, and if there's no new services, it's still the same services. Where does the money is going? We just needed a transparency from residents to justify the price increase.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily like full stop, we want to pay less. Obviously, that would be ideal, but if you are going to pay more, you want there to be better communication, better transparency regarding where that money is going.
Yeah, just to have a clear understanding of like, okay, we are paying that money, we should know where that money is going.
Mm-hmm. Have you received any communications thus far?
We had that meeting, and then we had our SGM recently last month, and we invited residents to come and have a one-to with the resident students, like to justify, like it's a way residents can have a direct communication with residents instead of sending an emails, and residents have to answer the questions at the same point. But residents and dining hall refused the invitation. They justified that they didn't have the time it was a very short notice for them to come and talk to students. Then they proposed to have, instead of a town hall, they proposed to have a tabling event, which is still postponed many times.
Where is the Residents Hall Association now in terms of just this campaign in general? I know that you've had that meeting now with SFU, and the petition has been out. You said there was about 300 or so signatures at the moment. But what, I guess, are the next steps?
We did send out an email to all the signing students about informing that we met with the residents, what was their response about the meeting and about the petition, and we also sent email informing students that we were planning town hall, but we also stated that the residents declined invitation, so students are aware that it's not just a petition that they signed and then there's no explanation about that. We did explain, students kept them updated, and we also conveyed that if residents doesn't have something, like they are not in the favor of town hall, but they are like, let's do a tabling event. We ended up agreeing for that, like, let's do that. We were planning to do it in the mid-March, which has been postponing to 10th April, which is end of semester, which doesn't make sense. Like, the semester is going to end. Many of us might leave residence because it's increasing prices, so we don't still have justifications of the prices, and they're just postponing the thing, claiming that they do not have the collective time to come out and give answers to the residents.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca. or cfur.ca. At the Civic Center in downtown Prince George, Clevitene, the Highway of Tears 20th Anniversary Symposium was held April 7th to 10th, 2026. The first symposium occurred in 2006. It gained attention not only from the community, but actually managed to raise national awareness on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples along Highway 16. 20 years later, people from all over the region are converging once again over the course of 4 days, each one focusing on where the movement began in 2006, where it is now in 2026, and where it's headed into the future. At the second day of the event on April 8th, we were fortunate enough to speak with BC Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief Terry Teagee and Chief Administrative Officer or Executive Director of Child and Family Services at Carrie Sicani Family Services, Mary Teagee. We bring you to that conversation at the Civic Center now. Ms. Teagee, it's a huge journey, but looking back, are you able to summarize a little of what was discussed yesterday in terms of where the movement started, and then we'll get into today's programming of where we are.
So yesterday we really talked about where we started, what the Highway of Tears and how the 2006 symposium came to be. And of course that started with when the 14-year-old Ayla Sarek Ogier went missing, and what ended up happening is that, you know, it was enough. It was just the catalyst that just said, okay, we got to do something. At the time, then Rena Zatorski was counselor of Clevitene Nation, and she put a challenge out and a call to all the other governments, organizations, to come forward and do something. And so we collaborated together at Carrie Sicani Family Services, and we actually, in less than 8 weeks, we had this symposium between 800 some days and 1,000 people some days. You know, so many different levels of government. Ministers were there, deputy ministers, solicitor general, attorney general of Canada, and all the other stakeholders came together, and that's how the recommendations report came to be. In 2006, a walk had started in Prince Rupert and then culminated in Prince George to begin the 2006 Highway of Tears Symposium.
Is there anything you want to add into the past, where we were moving into to where we are, Terry?
Well, I think I got to recognize where we're at that time in 2006. I mean, this was a culmination of everything over the last 15, 20 years. There were many initiatives in Vancouver about missing and murdered just women and girls in the downtown east side. And much of the attention, national attention, was drawn there. But then this started gaining traction in terms of the Highway of Tears, missing, murdered just women and girls. I recall many stories that were brought up. And I was, you know, sharing that story with anybody who would listen, and including my wife. And then, you know, this happened with Aaliyah. And at that time, she was on council. And I just, matter of fact, I was just finishing university at the time at UNBC. Both my wife and I were UNBC students. And she put this challenge out. And I think at that time, too, as well, really calling out the ministers and the politicians, and some of them, matter of fact, came up to their credit. I suppose they were held accountable to bring forward the Solicitor General and what have you, came forward with the resources and funding. And also all the other political organizations came forward to start working on this issue. You know, it ended up becoming bigger than just the Highway of Tears, because it became a provincial-wide thing. Because there were many, many missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the downtown east side, right? That was really important.
Obviously, to understand the present issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples, we have to consider the past. But today's symposium theme is centered around where we are. What are you able to share about the movement's present focus? Would you like to speak to that, Mary?
Well, I think you have to realize where we're at now. Like, it has taken us 20 years to get here. The Highway of Tears Recommendations Report, Recommendation 32, had called for an annual symposium so that we can report out on the achievement of the many recommendations. That never happened because we didn't have the committed funds, the commitment to make the change from every level of government, including the RCMP. So here we're at, finally having the symposium after 20 years and looking at where we are today. We have achieved some of the recommendations, but there's still a lot of work to do, and so there still needs to be more funding, more resources, and more personal commitment to make that fundamental change that we're all seeking, and that's just to make a better and safer world for our children.
Would you care to add anything to where we're at presently with the movement, Terry?
Well, over the last 20 years, you see parties come and go, federally and provincially, and the problem that I see in regards to Indigenous issues such as this or any other issues is that these parties, the first thing that they generally do is, you know, ignore First Nations rights. You know, that's the first thing to go in terms of commitments in regards to what was already committed to perhaps by the previous administration or party. And that's a real problem. There's no consistency. There's no, as you heard before, you know, the resources brought to bear are always reneged, or the promises that were supposed to be there aren't followed through or cut. And that's always an issue. We see this not only here, but we see this nationally. The current report card in terms of implementing the National Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry, it's not there. It started out very minimally, and it's gotten even worse, I would say.
Looking at tomorrow's symposium, where we're going, you've touched on a few of these points already, but what does a foreseeable future hold in your view?
Tomorrow what we're going to be doing is we're going to be listening to the families and to the participants of the symposium, much like we did back in 2006. In 2006, we listened to the stakeholders, we asked questions of the families, we asked questions of the government, and we asked RCMP questions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how the 33 recommendations came to be. And so tomorrow, what we're hoping to do is to look at those gaps, to look at what are the priorities now, and then to revamp and to update the Highway of Tears Recommendations Report, Highway of Tears Recommendations Report 2.0, perhaps. So that's what we're going to be doing tomorrow, is really looking forward as to what we need to do moving forward. And really, I think we're looking at some of the speakers tomorrow on the panels. It's really about a sense of hope that we want to make sure that the families and citizens of Canada have.
The symposium's closing event is occurring Friday, April 10th, at Cottonwood Island Park in Prince George, Clayton-Tanay, where the Pillar of Hope will be unveiled between 9:30 a.m. and 2 p.m. You've heard remarks from Chief Administrative Officer or Executive Director of Child and Family Services at Carrier-Sicani Family Services, Mary Teege, at the Highway of Tears 20th Anniversary Symposium at the Civic Center in downtown Prince George, Clayton-Tanay, Wednesday, April 8th, 2026. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News update. After decades of work by local ecological groups, Hamilton Marsh Regional Park is officially open. With the snowy Mount Arrowsmith shining brightly in the background of the marsh, the Regional District of Nanaimo, or RDN, celebrated with partners on Wednesday, April 7th, its acquisition of the Hamilton Marsh Regional Park and Conservation Area. The Hamilton Marsh is located south of Qualcomm Beach, within RDN Littoral Area F and partly in Area G. Dignitaries, community organizations, funders, and supporters all came together to celebrate the ribbon cutting of the new 364-acre regional park.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The $28 million purchase from Island Timberlands, which is managed by Mosaic Forest Management, came after 30 years of advocacy work from local organizations and community supporters.
All that we are is story, from the moment we are born to the time we continue on our spirit journey. We are involved in the creation of the story of our time here. It is what we arrive with. It is all we leave behind. We are not the things we accumulate. We are not the things we deem important. We are story, all of us. What comes to matter then is the creation of the best possible story we can while we're still here. You, me, us, together. When we can do that and we take the time to share those stories with each other, we get bigger inside, we see each other, we recognize our kinship, we change the world one story at a time. Richard Wagonese.
That was Carrie Peasy, the president of the Hamilton Wetlands and Forest Preservation Society. She has been advocating for the preservation of the marsh for over 20 years. PC told the crowd that over the last 20 years as the Hamilton Wetlands and Forest Preservation Society, two other attempts were made to secure the land. But because of all the hard work and dedication of volunteers and community members, the third time was the charm.
It's my understanding that the two prior negotiations were for a wetland and a buffer only. Once we caught wind of it, we started with the mantra, preserve Hamilton Marsh, the whole 360. We were told, don't be married to the outcome.
She says the last several decades of advocacy has been a roller coaster of emotions, working towards saving all of the marsh.
I've been told it's too big. I've been told we can never get it all. I've been told we can't afford it. It didn't matter to us. People needed to know why we needed the entire ecosystem intact.
So when she got a call from RDN General Manager of Recreation and Parks, Tom Osborne, she couldn't believe the news.
I said, where's the vinegar, Tom? Where's the vinegar? And he said, there's none. I just can't believe it.
Originally, the purchase offer was $30 million. But Mosaic Forest agreed to lower the purchase terms to $28 million in their own effort to help preserve the marsh. According to the RDN, to fund the purchase, their board approved a long-term borrowing of $21.2 million and committed over $4 million of capital reserve funds. As well, local organizations such as the Nanaimo Area Land Trust, the Mount Arrowsmith Biosphere Region, the Hamilton Wetlands and Forest Preservation Society, as well as the Oceanside chapter of Ducks Unlimited Canada, were able to raise a total of almost $550,000 from community donations. The remaining funds were secured through contributions from the Nature's Trust of British Columbia, the SICA Foundation, and the Province of British Columbia, in partnership with Environment and Climate Change Canada and Parks Canada. RDN Board Chair and Director of Electoral Area H, Stuart McLean, says the regional district's work to preserve the marsh dates back to 1995.
At 364 hectares in size, the Hamilton Marsh Regional Park and Conservation Area is a natural asset that preserves several wetland habitats in addition to the marsh and supports wildlife listed as species of concern or at risk and as part of our French Creek watershed. This ecologically significant wetland and the extensive surrounding mature forest are located within the coastal Douglas fir biogeoclimatic zone.
He says they are grateful to the many who worked hard for years to ensure the Hamilton Marsh continues to be an integral part of the ecosystem for all generations to come.
We will be working with our partners in the development of a park and conservation area plan starting next year, and with careful planning, this site will provide people with a chance to see firsthand the importance of these lands while also letting nature do what it does best without a lot of human intervention.
Graham Sukecki, Regional Research Institute Manager for the Mount Arrowsmith Biosphere Region, says securing Hamilton Marsh helps advance British Columbia's process towards Canada's 30 by 30. Canada's 30 by 30 is a conservation goal set by the Government of Canada to protect 30% of land and water by 2030. The Hamilton Marsh Regional Park and Conservation Area has become the Nanaimo Regional District's 13th regional park. More information on regional parks in the RDN can be found at rdn.bc.ca/parks-services. For C2I News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. On Saturday night at the Smithers Legion, community members gathered to celebrate the Bulkley Valley's watersheds through music and conversation. The event was hosted by What Matters in Our Valley, a grassroots group founded in 2017 to protect local rivers, wildlife, and quality of life in the valley. Local performers including Teresa Michelle, Bill Crossan, Edward Quinlan, The Chesterfields, and Reckless Mountain played songs dedicated to the valley, while speakers such as Tom Roper and Len Vanderstar shared updates on the Telkwa Coal Project, now owned by Bathurst Resources Limited. The event raised over $1,000 to support research and expert analysis, highlighting strong local engagement around the future of the valley.
Make a switch there. Teresa is right behind me, and she's going to give us some of her personal music, and this girl is very talented. Teresa from Telkwa.
I've lived on the Telkwa River since 2006. I'm Tsuut'en traditional territory. And it's really an incredibly important part of my life. I've had so many changes over the 20 years in Telkwa, and every year the river changes too. It's just amazing. So beautiful.
I
We're just setting a little bit with the music. I've got a statement I just wanted to pass on to you. When we were talking with the people from Telkwa Coal, it was actually quite interesting. One of the guys came down and was speaking with one of the ladies in Telkwa Averling Coal Mine Road area. And he came, knocked on her door and was trying to get information about what they were doing. And he said to her, please don't worry about your water. He said, if we cause any problem, we'll provide you with bottled water for the rest of your life. And I found that just so profound. I couldn't get over that. And obviously, he didn't live in Telkwa or Smithers because he wouldn't worry about that.
Hey, thanks for having me here. Yeah, this is an important cause. I don't feel like I need to talk too much on it. We've got some really great speakers talking about what's going on here. Thought about doing some songs about coal and that sort of thing, but never quite got around to it. But I thought I'd do some love songs for you, because that's kind of why we're here, is love for the valley and, yeah, this place that we live. I had a request for a song. I don't really do requests unless I wrote them, so that doesn't happen very often. The song's about my cat Punky. It's a love song.
I like the song.
What information do you want people to know about Telkwa Coal and about tonight as well, and why does this outreach matter?
Well, I think this getting the public out and becoming more involved is exactly what we need. We need this, everybody, you know, regardless of how they feel about it, to become more aware of what's going on. It's going to be a huge mine that they propose, and it's 7 kilometers from Telkwa, and it's fractured and faulted land, and you can't keep it covered, and the risks are just way too great. It's a really dirty, high sulfur coal that they're going to wash with our clean water and put it right in the Telkwa. So it's and it's a very volatile market, and the coal is plentiful. Coal, there's more coal than any other fossil fuel in the world. Why do they want to destroy a beautiful place for something we shouldn't be burning in the first place anymore? You know, the markets have fallen. They've changed hands 8 times. They've gone bankrupt. Those are all things we need to keep in mind. They're not being truthful in talking to people about the risks and about the closeness, 7 kilometers. And the open pit will be as steep as a 30 to 40 story building upside down in the ground, you know? It's like lots of blasting, lots of fractured and faulted acid-generating rock. It just doesn't make any sense. It's just people that want to make money and destroy this place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I want people to know, is that, you know, I would always talk to you. People think about the jobs, but who's going to take care of it in perpetuity when the company folds in 3 years? Or, I mean, in the beginning, you always try to be thoughtful and not say, come out opposed, because you want to be really thoughtfully study everything. Yeah. The reports are really long, and we get people to read them, and we review them, and we get experts to look at them, and they give us their opinion. So hopefully at the forum, the community forum, people can ask questions. And but then we want everybody to get involved in writing letters and letting people know how they feel.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.